Welcome to Foreman Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And Cindy, I know that you are just cooped up in your farmhouse
yes.
with about 1,415 cookbooks.
I am. That's funny.
And a lot of pots.
I've never, yeah, a lot
You've
of
never counted them,
pots,
have you?
Pans, knives.
I'm just,
I have
I'm
a lot
ballparking.
Of knives. Yeah, yeah.
I believe that.
And a lot of tools.
You probably shouldn't say the thing about the knives in case you have visitors.
That's not what they're for.
It's the middle of winter and you're locked up.
Mm-hmm.
And
jeez, this is a dreary story you're telling.
No, but it's a story of a lot of people right now. They want to be outside. They want to feel the sun.
Oh, well.
Instead, they feel a chill.
The last few days, we really wanted to feel the sun.
Yeah, and instead, they feel a chill. And they have all these books. They have all this inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, you don't have the markets are not the same to go to at this time of the year to go find some inspirational eggplant or something. You know, you usually dig in books for those kinds of things.
The inspirational
so
eggplant.
So when you're at home daydreaming about food, what are the recipes that you're dying to get to this winter?
Well, I love cassoulet, and it's sort of a little bit of a holy grail for me. There's a restaurant in Paris called Benoit, and I just love their cassoulet. I think their version.
I'd like their. You love their cassoulet.
I love their cassoulet.
I like it.
I also think they have the best escargot. Now we're going to hear how Tony feels about their escargot.
Oh, escargot is love, capital L.
Yeah, their escargot is the best I've ever actually had. But anyway.
The cassoulet.
So cassoulet. So I also...
there's
so many different versions of cassoulet.
Explain for listeners, in general, what they would expect from cassoulet.
Okay. So it's... Cassoulet denotes the pot or the earthenware dish
Type of casserole.
Yeah, exactly. That's where that came from. So cassoulet is actually a dish, earthenware dish. And the idea is that you cook beans and basically meat, different types of meat, in slowly, very slowly, in the dish. And because this is old cooking, of course, and when women, you know, they sort of had their days delineated for what chore they had to do. I believe it was washing day, and this is very typical in the South as well. And since I've done so much research about Southern cooking, I've read a lot about how, you know, certain things are made on certain days in the South because of washing day or ironing day or whatever the different days were, work days. So on washing day, the ladies would make their cassoulet and take it down to the baker because the baker would work so early in the morning in the little village and, of course, had good hot ovens and were using wood to keep them hot or make them hot. As the baker was winding down their day and getting their bread done and sold, their ovens were still hot. So the ladies would make their cassoulet, bring it down to the local baker, put it in their ovens, and it would very gently bake for, you know, in those wonderful, you know, wood-smoked environments for many hours. And then the whole idea was it would bake very slowly, and they would not disturb the cassoulet, and they even talked to the point of that the door wouldn't open to the shop and that nothing would disturb the crust that would form on the top of the cassoulet. And
that's then, a little romantic to think that the door wouldn't open on the
shop. I know,
shop.
But I love that story, so that's why I told it. And so you really do want a crust to form, and then eventually that crust is broken back into the cassoulet and allowed to basically form again. So,
well, the crust has some breadcrumbs. So that kind of thickens up
the liquid, right?
Yeah.
So you have to have liquid to cook beans, and tarbé beans were the traditional bean that was used to make cassoulet. But I'm sure they've used all different types of beans in different regions that would make cassoulet.
Yeah, tarbé are a little bit rounder and a little bit bigger than cannellini beans, but it's not a giant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not a million miles from a white navy bean or.
Right. And I think, you know, as we adapt old recipes like this to our own cultures and what's available to us and our own needs, I love to use cocoa beans, which is a French bean as well.
Little and tiny beans.
They're little tiny, yeah, and I love that. And you don't have to do that. You can use any kind of...
You love cute
ingredients.
You
could use red beans I wouldn't go so far to change it to something like a black-eyed pea, which is too soft and has a totally different flavor. But the idea is to use the tarbé bean. And then it typically would have duck-like confit. I think
that's
kind of
that's a garnish like when they serve that in restaurants, right? That's not part of the original dish that's baked all together.
The original dish had all different types of sausages in it. and
big pieces of the bacon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the cured pork belly.
Cured, yeah.
That,
yes,
that sort of business, all riddled through with the beans and lots of garlic. And
lots of garlic. Well, and that's the cooking of the region. This is from southwestern France.
Yeah, that's the heaviest stuff in the world.
Mm-hmm. And so good stock, lots of different, you know, types of sausages, or you could use just one type. And yes, I guess the confit leg sticking out of the top of it is very appealing and is sort of a restaurant adaptation, as you said, but I think it's a good one because I just love having that duck confit meat in there with all the sausages and the big pieces of pork
yeah.
belly.
Yeah, seeing
but
that,
it's a great dish.
Seeing that stark bone and the crispy
mm-hmm.
skin sticking out of there is kind of a carnivorous coup de grace, right?
Right. So if you were going to make it, just have some onion product, a good amount of. And I always tend towards butter poaching my garlic now. The longer I cook, the more often I do it. You don't have to do it that way, which would be just to chop the garlic and immerse it in butter and cook it very, very slowly. I like garlic to be mild, and it is a very good way to handle it.
People do. I mean, that's not the traditional, but people definitely do. They usually want a little punch out of that.
Mm-hmm. And so then you can just saute it in butter or olive oil or something with the other ingredients. But cassoulet is a great dish, and one of the nice things about it is once you have it put together, you just put it in the oven and you kind of forget about it and put the, you know, sort of buttery breadcrumb on top. And, you know, after a couple of hours or an hour, hour and a half, just kind of go back in, break the crust, just stir it around a bit and put maybe a tiny bit more breadcrumb on top and let it go for another hour or so and just let it be gently done. And you have this wonderful self-sustaining dish for dinner. I mean, you don't really need anything else. Personally, I would make a big green salad that, you know, had a great acidic dressing and, you know, probably a traditional red wine vinaigrette with a little Dijon mustard and a good extra virgin olive oil and call it a day. You really don't need anything else. It would be nice to have the refreshing salad with something that's so heavy.
It would be nice. That's funny. I'm thinking about what, you know, like 150 years ago, 200 years ago, it probably would be more very garlicky sauteed turnip greens or something like that that wilted to be served alongside of that.
So what wine do we drink with cassoulet?
Big old monsters in the southwest of France.
Monsters.
You know, Madurin and, you know, the Cahors. Cahors is one of those wintertime, you want it sort of wines. The wine that was the predecessor is a famous red wine from the southwest of France before Bordeaux.
Mm-hmm.
And Cahors is the original quote-unquote black wine of France. It's the wine from the southwest from Malbec, which you don't think of being a French grape. It's one of the Bordeaux grape, and what you see a lot in South America now. But that there's a very, very old estate, Jean Jouffroux's estate, Clos de Gamo, has been at it since 1110.
Wow.
Yeah, since Charlemagne rolled through the neighborhood. The families were making wine in the same place. And that's about 200 years before Chateau Aubryon was on paper as having a name, which is the oldest before that. Aubryon, you know, is Irish origin. It was the place of O'Brien.
Got it. Wow, that's
which
cool.
Which is kind of funny.
Interesting.
A lot of the southwest of France have that mixed English-Irish.
I have a side question, Tony. So was Bordeaux really popular or expensive, or both, before World War II? Or did that occur sort of after World War II?
Ooh, that's
or
a
World War One?
I'll make very short a very long and complicated question.
Okay, yeah, just...
Before the 1855 classification of Bordeaux,
mm-hmm.
Where there were things were knocked into growths, right?
Yes.
Basically, sort of like price tiers. First, second, third, fourth, fifth, bourgeois, you know, and then just Bordeaux Superior, Bordeaux. You know, all these classifications that helped buyers and helped become more of a commodity wine.
Mm-hmm.
The English sort of dominated a lot of the wine trade, especially the Bordeaux trade coming from that area. They were, you know, the shippers around the world of a lot of stuff, and also obviously back to Britain, or to the wealthy northern parts of Europe. And you see the British influence on the commerce of it. But it's funny, Bordeaux was not as popular or well-known as Cahors, the other wine that I mentioned,
mm-hmm.
for a long time. The problem was silt. There are two rivers, the Garonne and the Lot. The Lot River silted up over time, and the bigger ships couldn't get down
the
river.
Okay.
When they couldn't get bigger ships down there to take bigger shipments of wine,
mm-hmm.
then they started going to Bordeaux, where they had deeper harbor. and getting the red wine from down there.
Okay.
It was purely economics that drove Bordeaux first and dropped Coeur back into being kind of like a sleepy, obscure wine.
And that was around 1855 with the classifications or no, this, later I, on? No,
over the course of the late 1700s and the 1800s, this was happening as that river was silting up and more trade started in Bordeaux.
Well, that leads me to another question, actually. So I didn't realize...
All these big wines, by the way, are to counteract all the garlic that's supposed to be in there, punch you in the face.
Right.
And Bordeaux is not necessarily the match, by the way.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's too...
You want something a little more robust.
Punch you in the face.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, definitely. So wine used to be shipped from France to England in barrels, and then they would bottle it in England?
You had shipping of cases. You had shipping of demijohns, or the big...
What's a...
The big glass, looking like giant Chianti bottles.
Okay, okay.
From the old day Chianti bottles with the wicker on them and all that sort of business,
mm-hmm.
the straw. And then you had shipping in barrel, and you had all different kinds of containers. You could buy by different types of containers. Most of the finest wines were shipped in bottle for a pretty long time from the late 1700s.
Tony, from talking about Cahors, would you be able to drink a bottle of wine that's 300 or 400 years old from a place like that, or?
No, a couple of different reasons. One logistical reason, a lot of times wines, even the biggest red wines, there were no sulfites, there were no preservatives of any kind.
Mm-hmm.
So oftentimes you might get a year or two out of them.
Oh, wow.
But they're meant to, think about how big and tannic a young red wine is.
Yeah.
You know, and immediately fruity it is. Those things are meant to kind of like counteract each other. But that's almost all red wines for a very long time. Especially if you wanted to drink wine from the 1100s, yeah, no, they would not have made it.
Okay,
that you could drink Cahors now, you know, anywhere from 4 or 5 years old till probably 30 years old is a good drinking window for a good vintage. Like 2001 right now is fantastic. 2005, fantastic right now. Cahors, if anyone is looking it up, is Cahors.
Well, with Cassolet, I mean, talk about food needing wine. You need wine with your Cassolet if you drink wine. So
yeah,
the two are perfect for each other.
Yeah, refresh your palate and...
And have some more.
And yeah, exactly right.
Cassolet is a great wintertime dish, and we definitely think about it this time of the year. And it's not expensive to make, so that's nice too.
No, a little time consuming, but honestly, it's not fine work if you're not the great person wielding a knife. You really don't have to do all kinds of crazy stuff. You have to come up with a couple of kinds of sausages. Like, what do you prefer?
I like a very garlicky sausage and
a pork sausage. Toulousienne-style pork sausage.
Mm-hmm. Not something with any spices in it. It needs to be very clean from the standpoint that it needs to have good fat,
so this is not
good flavor.
This is not andouille.
No.
This is not merguez.
No, it's just a good pork. I would do a pork sausage, and if you could find a lamb sausage, I would do probably both. And then I really do like the confit, and if you don't feel like going through that process, which is another time-consuming process, not hard to do because all you have to do is, you know, season the duck legs. You know, you don't have to do anything to them. They have fat on them. The skin, you know, it's in good shape, ready to go. Season them and immerse them in duck fat and cook them for a couple of hours until they're tender, and then that becomes a part of the cassolet. But, a couple of different types of good lamb and pork sausage. And
you need the bacon, right? You need
and
this is not like bacon you buy in the store. That's like
belly.
Thin sliced.
No, you want pork belly. You want a piece of pork belly. And I would cut it into probably 2-inch, 3-inch wide pieces.
Yeah,
you know, you want it to be pretty wide, and you want it to hold together while it's cooking. It's not something
it's gonna shrink
you don't
down.
Want it to disintegrate. Well,
it's mostly
shrink fat.
Down. Yeah,
right. It's got so much fat in it that you don't want a lot of that in there because the fat will melt out.
The fat from that pork belly is going to have a beautiful relationship with that breadcrumb when it goes back in there with the beans.
It is.
and that gnarly garlic, right?
Yep.
That's what's going to make you sleep at night through the long winter.
Right. And then the next thing I was thinking about was venison. So
when we come back on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine, Cindy Wolf and all the deer, all of that and more on WYPR. Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
The last we left you, you were running around with a deer in the forest. So what kind of wintertime goodies do you have from the venison?
One of my favorite things to do with venison, because it is so lean, is to grill it and cook it very quickly. So you do want to get some char, especially if you have the opportunity to work on a wood-burning grill, to be able to add that smoke flavor to the meat and to, you know, you can even put a little bit of foil. If you do have a wood-burning grill, put a little bit of foil over the meat as it roasts, or excuse me, grills, and impart even more flavor.
Catch a little extra
but
smoke.
But you have to be super careful with it because it is lean. And now I'm talking about farm-raised venison. A little bit of oil, salt, pepper is great. Rosemary goes very, very well with venison. A little bit of juniper berries crushed in to make a marinade goes very, very well with venison. You could even go onto another totally different end of the spectrum of spices and crush a little star anise, a little bit of clove, and even maybe a little bit of nutmeg, and just make an oil and put a tiny bit of chili powder in there, something that's spicy, and have sort of that wonderful sort of perfumed earthiness of those spices with a little bit of heat. And I would make that oil, and then I would strain it through a fine sieve. I would not put all those products directly on the venison, but it's a good way to marinate it if you do want to marinate it. I would not put acid in there. I personally have never cooked wild venison, so I can't speak to how to work with it. But with farm-raised venison, it does tend to be tender as long as you're cooking it rare or medium rare.
Because it's so lean, it needs to be. Mm-hmm. It's just like the leaner the meat that you cook, the faster the texture is going to tighten up. So if you normally like meat medium, you may like venison.
Medium rare.
Like beef medium, you may like venison medium rare.
Right.
So with that lean venison, what do you want to serve?
I think a potato gratin would be good because of the fat in it and giving balance to the dish.
So can you briefly sort of step by step that gratin, what do you like to make?
Thin layers of, and I use Yukon Gold potatoes, thin layers of potatoes sliced into the gratin with cream on the bottom, a little bit of butter, and then in between each layer, just a small amount of cream, a tiny bit of Reggiano cheese and Gruyere cheese, and salt and pepper,
so
and just bring
you
the
keep
layers.
Keep seasoning each layer.
Mm-hmm. And it's about, I would say, probably 6 to 7 layers is a good quantity of how many layers of potato to put into it. But
sliced,
it also depends on.
Sliced pretty thin, and you end up with something that's what, a couple of inches high?
No. I wouldn't go, I would say about an inch high, maybe an inch and a half. But like I said, I would say probably 7 or 8 layers of potato. And you bake that gently in the oven with foil over it so that it steams while it bakes. And then near the end of the cooking process, and you want to bake it at about 325 degrees in a non-convected oven, as it comes to the end of the cooking process, it typically takes right at 40 minutes at 325 degrees.
Variations on the potato gratin? Are there stuff you'd want to use, or with different seasoning of the meat, would you want to vary it?
You could make it with parsnips and celeriac, but or if you wanted, you could do a zucchini gratin. But you know, we don't have to. There are plenty of other things you can serve with.
Yeah,
you can. There are plenty of other things you can serve with the venison. I like the idea of going towards dried fruit as an accompaniment.
So you're working out your items that you locked up in the house and are dying to cook. So. After the venison, what else is on your list?
I've been getting Jonah crabs, and I really think they're amazing. That's what we all think of as stone crabs, and which, you know, they're a pretty good sized body on the crab. They weigh probably about, you know, I'd say 18 ounces. The claws obviously have a lot of meat in, which is why people.
These are kind of like the big Popeye looking crab claws, right?
Yeah, Their texture is so very different from our blue crabs, but they're very good, and I know a lot of people really love them. So when I saw I had them available, I had never purchased them, actually, as a chef. So, and also thinking about going to, you know, Joe's Stone Crab Claw place in Florida when I was a kid with my mom and dad made me think, you know, I really kind of, not only do I want to get those in, but I'd like to eat one. It's been so long since I had one, and I obviously don't typically do that, but... we got them in, and what we did was we put on a pot of water with the tops of celery, probably, you know, 20 black peppercorns, say 10 bay leaves, and a little bit of white wine and a lot of water, and boiled them. And I actually cooked them for 7 minutes. And then we shocked them in ice water, immersed them in ice water to stop the cooking process. And I started pulling the meat out of the claws, and then there's a tiny bit of meat in the body, and I kind of quickly gave up on that. It's nothing like a blue crab where you have those beautiful pockets of lump and back fin. So the meat really is in the claw, and the meat is super sweet. That's why people like it so much. And actually, not the claw end, but the arm of the claw, that meat has a very good texture compared to the meat that's on the claw itself. So I bought them again yesterday, and I decided to approach it a little differently. I wanted to make sure that I reserved, instead of eating some of the meat itself, I wanted to reserve it all and see how much I could actually get.
I wonder what's going to happen to your food cost in February.
You're right.
January, yeah.
So I ended up with probably about a cup and a half of claw meat. And let me tell you, it took me a long time. It's a little painstaking.
And that's dedication.
Yeah. And once I steamed them open and then pulled the meat out, then I began to make the stock. So I broke open the body with a pretty heavy knife that I wasn't worried about hurting the blade edge, and cut them in half. You have to remove the lungs. They are bottom dwellers. You know, they've got some mud on them. So by the time you've boiled them, shocked them, they've hit water twice, once hot, once cold. Some of the mud will come off, but you need to scrub them a little bit before you go to make the stock. And the lungs are full of sand, so you really want to make sure you remove those lungs really carefully. And then if you don't like the interior of the crab, most of them were sort of golden inside. The one was sort of dark brown, and I think that just had a lot of mud in it. So I discarded that one. But
it sounds like a lot of disparagement.
It's a lot
of judgment.
Of work is what it is, disparagement. So I put my soup pot on. Put corn oil in it, so you want a neutral oil, made it hot, very hot, and then I sautéed the shells, and all the shells. So while I was cooking the bodies and the claw shells, and I was still working on the extension of the arm, I just added those as I got them finished. And so in the stock went carrot, celery, onion, again, bay leaf, and peppercorn. I did not, and tomato paste.
So all these ingredients you added to like the toasted shells from sautéing them in the big soup pot.
And that's how I made the stock. And at this point, I put no alcohol in. I cooked them in white wine and
so
water.
So you just covered the white wine and water?
No, I did not put any alcohol in when I made the stock. But yes, I put enough liquid in to probably cover it by about 4 inches. And I put just a couple tablespoons of tomato paste. I didn't want to blow out the flavor of the crab because it is so good. And you do get this really pure, a beautiful taste of the crab meat in the stock. So I cooked it for about 2 hours, which is a long time to cook a seafood stock. And you bring it up to a boil, turn it down onto the lowest temperature, and just let it simmer or cook gently. And then strained it. And I strained it through a chinois, which is a fine sieve. It's a conically shaped sieve. And then I passed it again just to make sure that I was not to have any sort of sand or dirt or whatever. And then I let it sit and settle. And then I poured off almost all of it, but I didn't have much of a problem with it at that point. And then to make the soup, everything's a process when you make something that's from scratch, and this is quite a process, quite frankly.
Sometimes people get a bowl of soup and they think, oh, you threw stuff in a pot.
Yeah, often not. So now I'm making the soup, so I saute onions and shallots and butter, and I added another couple of carrots, one rib of celery, and the stock, brought it up to a boil. I added a couple more tablespoons of tomato paste, and seasoned it with freshly ground nutmeg, a little bit of mace, a pinch of cayenne pepper, and I put in Amontillado sherry and a quart of cream and let it reduce down. And I had decided to add a light roux to it. It really had a very, very light body to it. It was sort of amazing how thin the stock is.
Even when you reduced it that long, it was still kind of thin-bodied.
Yeah, and actually I added about 4 ounces of roux to it. So it gave it a little bit of body, and then I strained it. I did not puree the soup. I strained it through, again, twice through a fine sieve, and just adjusted the seasoning. I added a little bit of salt and a little bit of freshly ground black pepper. And then now when I serve it, I will add a little bit of the crab meat to it in the soup pot once it's hot, and just stir it and pour it into the bowl with no other garnish. It really doesn't want any other garnish. Sometimes I add fresh chives, finely chopped chives to crab soup, or maybe a little bit more sherry on top of the soup, but it just doesn't, it doesn't need anything. It's really pretty. So I was pretty excited to get to work with those crabs and to have them available. They came from New Jersey, off the coast of New Jersey. So I was surprised by that. I just, you know, and then doing a little research, they do come from Newfoundland down through the coast of Florida, of course. So it's a long range for those guys.
In Maryland, we're always blue crab centric, and
absolutely, and understandably so. They're delicious.
Have almost no concept of what
I understand.
To these things.
Well, I grew up on blue crabs too. I mean, my parents are from Pennsylvania, so you know, it was fun to kind of bring back that memory from going to that fun restaurant when I was a kid. And I you know, I remember that restaurant just being full of people. You know, they probably do like 800 people, and I wonder what they do now, but I'm sure it's still as popular. But you know, I can just remember being overwhelmed by all the people in there, and they had this amazing mayonnaise that they served with the stone crab claws, and as a child I remember thinking it was awfully good. So it was just kind of fun to relive that memory, food memory, which it really does. That's another thing that's so amazing about food. So Tony, with the stone crab soup in particular, what would you drink with that?
Soup is not ever an easy pairing.
Hmm. Why is that?
It's hot.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
So I mean, like as a wine pairing, it really, like, and people often want soup smoking hot.
That's for sure.
So exactly what
I can attest
to
that.
It's not so easy to taste those things on your palate. Mm-hmm. Soup usually, like, you order because you want the function of it being hot. So, I honestly, if I was having something like that at home, or to me, that seems like the kind of thing you would have, like, sitting at a really nice bar.
Yeah.
I would have a drink with it. I would have a...
Okay.
Maybe an American whiskey drink with it, or, you know. I mean, frankly, that's something as dumb and easy as an old-fashioned or something.
Okay.
If I was going to have wine with it, probably it's something fortified and something a little bit more savory is what I want it to be, and not fruity. So, like a Montiato Sherry, or that might be too strong.
Well, that's what's in it.
Yeah.
So.
That might be too
strong.
But I
only put a little bit in it.
For the delicate flavor of the crab.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have tomato in there, obviously, to correct the acidity on the dish. So that is not like cold white wine. No, I don't particularly want that with that. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Tannic red wine, doesn't make a lot of sense to me. But sherry, maybe dry Madeira, Sercial Madeira, might be very good, actually, now that sort of puzzling it out.
Mm-hmm. Good.
But yeah, soup is not easy. Like stews and that sort of thing are much easier. Or like a brodo, like a broth with a, you know, a stuffed pasta or something in it, that's much easier. But no, soup, especially like that, not so easy for wine.
So what are you cooking wintertime at home?
Well, we preserve a lot of stuff in the summer, you know. Our daughter is 3. She wants pasta and tomatoes or pasta and cheese pretty often. She's a good eater, and she loves her salmon, and she loves fish. And if I bring home a really pretty piece of tuna and catch sashimi and just season it, she will sit there and eat it with little chopsticks amazingly and love it. I mean, she loves that. But a lot of the tomatoes we put up the roasted cherry tomatoes. Mm-hmm. There's one, we'll often just use strozzapreti, just dried strozzapreti. A little shape that's literally translates as priest jokers. But they're a good size to get on a 3-year-old's fork and in a 3-year-old's mouth. And it's kind of ridiculous and old-fashioned, but like really good little meatballs, like turkey meatballs with those guys.
Mm-hmm.
They have a little zip to them, a little bit of garlic in them. And the roasted tomatoes from the summer cooked down with the meatballs. And that pasta and lots of Parmigiano and lots of fresh basil. Just for like a plate of something warm to make everybody in the family happy, not think too hard, it's not so bad. All right, when we come back on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine, it's meatballs. Well, it's all kinds of other things. And the chef's challenge is coming your way. Chef Cindy Wolf.
I can't wait.
On Formidable from Food and Wine. Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
Meatballs.
Mm-hmm. It's just a great way to
feed a lot. I keep
thinking
it's going to be funny when I say meatballs to you, and you just don't think it's funny.
No, that's because I'm hungry, and I'm thinking about what I would actually do right now if I was making meatballs, which I'd like to make them from lamb and pork, or pork and veal, or veal and chicken. You know, having a couple of different types
mixed
of meat. Yeah,
mixed.
And I was talking about chili powder earlier, especially if I'm doing, let's just say I'm doing pork straight. And I would add a little bit of chili powder. I'd add a little bit of saffron if I had it. I'd grind it in my hand and really rub it into the meat mixture. Salt, pepper. And I put a little bit of what we call panko. So a little bit of that's a really crispy kind of neutral.
Just a really airy, neutral breadcrumb.
Breadcrumb, yeah. It's perfect for this. I usually put two, I'm making 5 pounds. So this is 5 pounds of ground pork. That's what I would make for
a
full
meal. Because when you're making dinner for the two of you.
Well, so I think they're all.
And you're really hungry.
They can figure out what I'm saying. So I usually put 2 to 3 whole eggs in, say, 5 pounds of ground meat. And I would probably put about a cup of breadcrumb. And you really have to season it. And you really should test it. That's the beauty of it. You know, before you make them, you can just make a little patty, a tiny little patty out of your force meat and saute it in a little saute pan, pop in the oven for a minute, or just do it so thin that you can do it straight on the stove
and
taste it.
Making a tiny little hamburger?
Yeah, make a tiny little hamburger. And
I'm sorry, I just like getting you to say that you're making hamburgers.
Yeah, well, you know how I feel about those.
Wait till you get your chef's challenge.
Oh, gosh. So you do need a little bit of breadcrumb. You do need a little bit of egg. And another way to go is to not use either one of those things and to put yogurt in there, which I love. So really good, you know, really good, thick, awesome, great yogurt. And I would definitely go sort of Middle Eastern spices with that. And that's a good place for sumac. It's a good place for a little bit of curry. Or make your own, or do your own spice mix of turmeric, cardamom, ground, obviously. A little bit of, you could do sage as well, which is not Middle Eastern, obviously, but is a different direction you could take it in. But there's just so many different spices. It's kind of what you're in the mood for. If you are drinking wine, what's going to go with your wine, and who your guests are.
Well, you don't do so much that you want to dominate it. That's
no,
people,
and when,
people get a little
right,
aggressive sometimes.
You want to taste them. You want to taste the ground pork or lamb, or don't say it, Tony.
Burger.
And
you want to do that test burger. It's okay. You can say it.
Mm-hmm. So.
Come on.
And then I like to cook it in tomato puree, a little stock, sautéed onions, a little bit of garlic, and just cook the meatballs in.
I'm talking the meatballs themselves.
Yeah. Or you can roast them in the oven, of course. So you could go either way. But I love to cook them very slowly in just a great tomato sauce, basically.
Just let them kind of caramelize in that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love. And then we make rice. We make a pretty neutral, you know, pretty straightforward rice with chicken, light chicken, maybe a little Tabasco, salt and pepper, and a little bit of onion sautéed in butter, and then a little extra butter doesn't hurt. So when you make rice, rice loves butter. So if you add a little bit right at the end before it starts to
cook. What do you make that doesn't love butter?
Everything loves butter. Everything in the world loves butter, except for the people that don't eat butter.
Well, they probably love it.
They
don't eat it.
They choose not to, right? Got it? So, yeah, I think meatballs can be a lot of fun to make. I mean, I remember when my mom made meatloaf when I was a child, and I truly hated meatloaf when I was a kid. And so for, ugh, God. God, I just really, I don't know. I think it was because she wouldn't cook the onions
was
before
the,
she...
Was the gravy thing?
It was a lot. No, there was no gravy.
Oh.
Oh, no, she never made, no.
That's tough.
No, no. There were a lot of big raw onions in there, and I think that's what really irritated me as a child.
So like it's a
Like
a well-done meatloaf.
I was born to be a chef, so I could make food that I liked.
Like a well-done meatloaf with... big old onion chunks in there.
Actually, that's not true because my mother was a great cook, but and my mother made a lot of very, very good food.
Well, maybe
but
that wasn't your favorite.
Meatloaf
item.
Was not her. Yeah,
it's
her
okay.
Bag.
You can say that wasn't a good dish.
Yeah, it wasn't. And then the other thing she would do is she would take. Oh gosh, I feel kind of bad saying this, but she would make a potato puree for dinner, and then the next day, I hate onions. I always hated onions when I was a kid because I think there was a lot of raw, large pieces of onion that went into food. That's not how you handle an onion. She would put
well, it's how your mom handled onions.
Big diced pieces of onion into the potatoes and lightly form them into a cake and lightly flour them and saute them, which that could have been really, really good. I think it was just the kind of raw onion aspect that I
sort of like
stand
a Pennsylvania Dutch latke.
I guess, yeah. Never thought of it that way, but yeah. I mean, it's a good way to utilize leftover potatoes. Why not? I would saute the onions first before I added it to the mixture, or else make them really tiny. So anyway, there we have it. Is it time for a chef's challenge?
I don't know. I'm still amazed that you're talking about your mom's onion issues on the radio. Yeah, I can give you.
My
mother
lives in North Carolina. She doesn't listen to the show.
Now that you're on a roll, why don't you go ahead? Okay, so your challenge, your circumstances.
Oh boy.
Hello.
I have a circumstance.
There's a very big football game coming.
Oh.
And you have people coming over that want to watch the football game. Gee, I wonder what this could be.
What do you mean?
The football game. Do you know?
Oh, what game it would be?
Yes,
I do, actually. Yes.
All right. So the circumstance is you have many people coming who want to eat sandwiches. And your mission is to take the ingredients that you have and make
sandwiches.
Stuff that you can pick up and eat between two pieces of bread.
Skirt steak, beef, ground pork, broccoli, provolone cheese, molasses. What?
Yeah.
Chili peppers.
You happen to have molasses.
Green tomatoes. Yukon Gold potatoes. Oh, my gosh, Tony. Dijon mustard. Pickled peppers. Bread of your choice.
You can't make a sandwich without having some kind of bread.
Some
or
sort of,
roll.
What does
or,
this say before the smoked bacon?
Smoked bacon.
Okay. And then that
hickory,
says...
Hickory, perhaps.
Yeah, it kind of looks like it. Pantry, dairy, spices, no fresh herbs?
Nope.
Oh, dandelion green. Oh, nope. Yeah, dandelion green's great.
This is a man food event.
All right.
Okay,
I can't even make sense of this list of food product you've given me here.
That's because it's for making sandwiches.
All right, well, obviously I have to grill the skirt steak, so I need to get... I sound very enthusiastic
so you're gonna
tonight.
You bet you can't wait till these people come over.
Well, this wouldn't be happening, okay? None of this would be happening, so we don't even have to worry about it. So grill the skirt...
You have a dress code for the football
steak.
Game? Is that...
Yeah. And then, obviously, it's going to be very, very thinly sliced. So light salt and pepper. I'm going to put a good bit of black pepper and cayenne and salt on the outside of the skirt steak. Grill it to medium rare. And then just let it cool down on the board. And the ground pork. I really don't know what I'm supposed to do with ground pork for a sandwich.
Perhaps you could make meatballs.
Yeah, make... Meatball sandwich. Oh, yeah. People do eat that, don't they? Oh, my gosh.
What?
Golly. All right. Oh. All right. Ground pork, chili peppers are
Touch
going
down.
Together, and then salt and pepper. I don't know. And then I'm going to make meatballs, apparently. And
you don't have to.
Wow. What am
you
I doing
You can make
with the
burgers.
So I'm just going to, I normally don't try to ignore your ingredients, but I don't know what I'm supposed to do with that molasses. So the green tomatoes, I'm obviously going to fry because that's going to be great on a sandwich. And that's what's going to go on the skirt steak beef sandwich, which is going to be on the best bread ever made, to man, which will be some form of baguette. And then I will cut the baguette I'm going to make toast points out of the baguette, right? Long ones. So I'll brush them with butter.
You can't make canapes. Okay, you can't make canapes. It's a sandwich.
All right, so I'm going
to make canapes.
I don't care what, this is my food. So I'm going to make them into toast
points. You're going to serve with a glass of rosé?
I'm going to lay thin layers of the, champagne. Pink rosé champagne. Come on. If I'm making sandwiches,
we're
having champagne.
And sandwich canapes.
Yeah. And then I'm going to melt the provolone.
It's your
on
second
there.
Touchdown. Yeah.
I'm going to melt the provolone and I forgot what I said I was doing with the chili peppers. The Yukon Gold potatoes, I'm going to make French fries with that. That's easy. The Dijon mustard is going to be the garnish for the, or the, what you dip your Yukon Gold potatoes in. Do you have mayonnaise on here? Well,
pantry.
I have some mayonnaise, yes, which I will mix with the Dijon mustard, and then I'll have my my pommes frites. The pickled peppers, which I do like the idea of those, so that will be also the garnish on the beef. Boy, that bruschetta is getting to be pretty serious.
God bless
bacon.
America.
Bacon. Bacon's going on that. Bacon's going on that too. And the ground pork, the meatballs. I'm going to make a salad with the broccoli. So that'll be extra virgin olive oil, a little bit of red pepper flakes, salt and pepper, small pieces of broccoli. So you can just kind of eat that with your sandwich. It'll be like the side, maybe a little bit of finely sliced onion with that. And then the dandelion greens tossed in at the end. That's just really weird. Oh, I'll put the dandelion greens on the sandwich too with the meatballs. Yeah, that'll be a nice accompaniment. And the meatballs need to be in a roll. So seeing that I'm from Pennsylvania, sort of, it's going to be a potato roll.
Oh.
I love those things.
I thought you were going to say pretzel roll.
No, a potato roll. Yeah.
Potato
All right,
roll.
That's it. I'm done with that.
Boy.
Don't ever give me a sandwich again, Tony.
Yeah, that was really irritating.
That was traumatic.
Yeah, that was really irritating for you. Gosh. Make a sandwich. For every person that's ever been up late at night wanting to have something really good to eat or wanted to watch a game with a large meal in their hand, that's why they have sandwiches. All right, so you get me.
Slightly different list of products.
Okay, I may have to read this with an accented voice. Pork belly, tripe, brace of quail. Sorry.
That's because I put brace,
brace
on there.
Brace, exactly,
That's
because
Tony
you put brace
has
of quail.
Has been transported back to the 1600s.
It's a pair of
in
quail.
In England, apparently.
Mm-hmm. Garlic, onion, shallot, carrot, celery. Iberico chorizo. So... So chorizo, Iberico chorizo, tomato puree, red cooking wine, spice cabinet. Let's throw the entire cabinet off the wall into the pot. Black beans, chicken stock. Okay. Awesome. There's one thing that I could make in a heartbeat. You sweat the garlic and the shallot and a little bit of celery for a good while. And the tripe, I'm going to sort of presume that the tripe has already been cleaned and lightly poached one time, just clean it out. The second time, okay, in a court bouillon. And then you want to slow cook it with a little bit of the red cooking wine and that sweated garlic and shallot, the tomato puree, a tiny little bit of that chorizo, some of the chicken stock, and hopefully if you have fresh bay or a couple of bay leaves. But you cook that for a while and stew that. And what you desperately need for that tomato poached tripe is an egg. You need a poached egg really badly.
Go for it.
That would be...
You have an egg.
And that's just great. You have that and you just
one
pop
per
that
person.
Egg and you crack it. One per person. It's yep. just the one of the best things in the whole world.
That does sound good. I gave you a much better list than you gave me.
You gave me a short list with... Well, I mean, the...
Things that you like.
The pork belly. Easy. That's... You cure it. You roast it. Even better, you like grill big old pieces of it. Mm-hmm. Now, that makes a good sandwich. You gave me nothing to make a sandwich with.
No, I did not.
Give me things to make stock with. You can use the pork belly to make a nice stock, to make a soup with the black
beans. Didn't I give you beans? Yeah. Right?
Yeah, give me the black beans. We make a black bean soup, but do it with the pork belly as a, crispy pork belly as a garnish and some of the pork belly to make a solid stock. That'd be good. Iberico chorizo is just great to eat. Would also be great to make stuffing if we had any breadcrumb for those quail. So let's see. So the meal is, that's the black bean soup. With pork belly as garnish and as the base of the stock. Iberico chorizo stuffed into the quail.
Mm. Fun.
Right.
That's fun. I like
little
that.
A little bit of carrot in the stuffing, too. Carrot, onion.
They don't have much of a cavity.
Celery, breadcrumb.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but...
No, but that'll be good.
Mostly, it's really seasoning the bird from the inside out. I mean, that's kind of... Mm-hmm. That's what you want. That strength of flavor is nice.
Doesn't take long to cook.
No, I mean, I would just sear the bejesus out of them on both sides in the pan and then slow roast it in the oven.
Is that a cooking term?
Yes.
Hmm.
Searing the bejesus.
Mm-hmm.
And then, what else is there to deal with? Oh, then the tripe. I mean, the tripe is the tripe. That's the best dish.
Got it.
So, when you do the Super Bowl party, what kind of drinks are you going to serve with your sandwiches?
Something with a lot of vodka in it. I don't know.
Welcome to Cindy Wolf's Super Bowl party, where there'll be lots of canapes and vodka.
Well, I can tell you what I did one time for a certain group of Shut Enough to Pop winemakers that came to
You did very traditional football game food.
Well, no, I made terrina foie gras with prunes and Armagnac.
Like I said.
And
very traditional for you. That's why
you're
telling the story.
Well, but I also made southern food because the lady that was the wife of the man that was entertaining the winemakers from Shut Enough is from the South. So I made collard greens, and I believe I made shrimp creole and rice. But I did have a couple of French dishes as well, which, I mean, that was a lot of fun. They loved everything. We had a great time.
These guys drank a mountain of wine at my house.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Because I think there was a rugby match.
Yes, there was an impromptu
in the living room.
Rugby match.
They did not understand the game, but they did understand that there was meant to be, after the much wine, there was big physical contact.
Yes. Yeah, it was quite a few years ago. People were younger.
Yes. And you're pointing at me, I know.
I'm not pointing
at anyone.
You can't
see it on the radio. Well, regardless of all that.
So with your tripe dish, what wine are you, your chef's challenge, what wine are you serving?
You can drink white or red with that dish. You can drink the white that's best from Piemonte. For that's probably Gavi di Gavi. Cortese is the grape. That does very well. If you're going to have a red, it's Barbera that you want. Something that's going to be like firm, bright, balance the acidity of the tomato. That's really kind of the trick. You might think, oh, it's an egg dish, I can drink sparkling. Like, no, you don't want something off dry. You don't want something tannic. Wine always has to function with the dish first. And the tomato and then the egg are the overriding things. And tripe is not strongly flavored.
Right.
It's delicately flavored and delicately textured. That's the nature of it. Yeah. Now with quail with the chorizo in it, that's a whole different thing.
Yeah, that's going to be some fun
You could do pretty big exotic red for that kind of guy. Quail has good flavor. The dish will end up having
reasonable
fat. How
about Vega Sicilia?
You could absolutely drink Vega Sicilia.
Ooh, that would be delicious.
You could trade in your Bentley for the Vega Sicilia. You can drink more modestly. Very good Rioja. Here's a quick tip. If you find any more 2009 Riojas out in the world, vintage is great. They can age a really long time. Watch for those. Even the Crianças will do reasonably. The Reservas especially will do very, very well for a long time in the cellar. If you can find nines. Tens also, but nines.
Okay. Good. Good.
So
that was fun.
I think that's all we have time mm-hmm. for. I know you got to get ready for your practice sandwich making. So if you want to follow Chef Cindy Wolf on social media and see all of her sandwich photographs, you would go to...
On Instagram, it's Chef Wolf. On Twitter, it's Chef Cindy Wolf.
Mine is The Real Tony Foreman. If you want to download podcasts of this...
Are there people impersonating you, Tony? Is that why it's The Real Tony Foreman?
I'm not certain, but I feel much more secure. I feel much more secure with that. If you want to download this broadcast or any others, please go and find podcasts on the WYPR website. Go to the Foreman Wolf homepage, and you can look them up there. And if you want to contact us, email us, please, foremanwolf@wypr.org. Thanks very much for listening.
Happy Sunday.